Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Chapter 5. A Wanderer. The catastrophe with Liza and the death of Marya Timofeyevna made an overwhelming impression on Shatov. I have already mentioned that that morning I met him in passing. He seemed to me not himself. He told me, among other things, that on the evening before, at 9 o'clock, that is, 3 hours before the fire had broken out, he had been at Marya Timofeyevna's. He went in the morning to look at the corpses, but as far as I know, gave no evidence of any sort that morning. Meanwhile, towards the end of the day, there was a perfect tempest in his soul, and I think I can say with certainty that there was a moment at dusk when he wanted to get up, go out, and tell everything. What that everything was, no one but he could say. Of course, he would have achieved nothing, and would have simply betrayed himself. He had no proofs whatever with which to convict the perpetrators of the crime, and indeed, he had nothing but vague conjectures to go upon, though to him they amounted to complete certainty. But he was ready to ruin himself if he could only crush the scoundrels, his own words. Pyotr Stepanovitch had guessed fairly correctly at this impulse in him, and he knew himself that he was risking a great deal in putting off the execution of his new awful project till next day. On his side there was, as usual, great self-confidence and contempt for all these wretched creatures, and for Shatov in particular. He had for years despised Shatov for his whining idiocy, as he had expressed it in former days abroad, and he was absolutely confident that he could deal with such a guileless creature, that is, keep an eye on him all that day, and put a check on him at the first sign of danger. Yet what saved the scoundrels for a short time was something quite unexpected, which they had not foreseen. Towards 8 o'clock in the evening, at the very time when the quintet was meeting at Erkel's and waiting in indignation and excitement for Pyotr Stepanovitch, Shatov was lying in the dark on his bed with a headache and a slight chill. He was tortured by uncertainty. He was angry. He kept making up his mind, and could not make it up finally, and felt with a curse that it would all lead to nothing. Gradually, he sank into a brief doze, and had something like a nightmare. He dreamt that he was lying on his bed, tied up with cords and unable to stir, and meantime he heard a terrible banging that echoed all over the house. A banging on the fence, at the gate, at his door, in Kirillov's lodge, so that the whole house was shaking, and a faraway familiar voice that wrung his heart was calling to him piteously. He suddenly woke and sat up in bed. To his surprise, the banging at the gate went on, though not nearly so violent as it had seemed in his dream. The knocks were repeated and persistent, and the strange voice that wrung his heart could still be heard below at the gate, though not piteously, but angrily and impatiently, alternating with another voice, more restrained and ordinary. He jumped up, opened the casement pane, and put his head out. "Who's there?" he called, literally numb with terror. "If you are Shatov," the answer came harshly and resolutely from below. "Be so good as to tell me straight out and honestly whether you agree to let me in or not." It was true. He recognized the voice. "Marie, is it you?" "Yes, yes, Marya Shatov, and I assure you I can't keep the driver a minute longer." "This minute, I'll get a candle," Shatov cried faintly. Then he rushed to look for the matches. The matches, as always happens at such moments, could not be found. He dropped the candlestick and the candle on the floor, and as soon as he heard the impatient voice from below again, he abandoned the search and dashed down the steep stairs to open the gate. "Be so good as to hold the bag while I settle with this blockhead," was how Madame Marya Shatov greeted him below, and she thrust into his hands a rather light, cheap canvas handbag studded with brass nails of Dresden manufacture. She attacked the driver with exasperation. "Allow me to tell you, you are asking too much. If you've been driving me for an extra hour through these filthy streets, that's your fault, because it seems you didn't know where to find this stupid street and imbecile house. take your 30 kopecks and make up your mind that you'll get nothing more. Eh, lady, you told me yourself Voznesensky Street, and this is Bogolyavolyensky. Voznesensky is ever so far away. You've simply put the horse into a stream. Voznesensky, Bogolyavolyensky. You ought to know all those stupid names better than I do, as you are an inhabitant. Besides, you are unfair. I told you first of all Filipov's house, and you declared you knew it. In any case, you can have me up tomorrow in the local court, but now I beg you to let me alone. Here, here's another 5 kopecks. With eager haste, Shatov pulled a 5 kopeck piece out of his pocket and gave it to the driver. Do me a favour, I beg you. Don't dare to do that. Madame Shatov flared up, but the driver drove off, and Shatov, taking her hand, drew her through the gate. Make haste, Marie, make haste. That's no matter, and you are wet through. Take care. We go up here. How sorry I am there's no light. The stairs are steep. Hold tight, hold tight. Well, this is my room. Excuse my having no light. 1 minute. He picked up the candlestick, but it was a long time before the matches were found. Madame Shatov stood waiting in the middle of the room, silent and motionless. Thank God, here they are at last, he cried joyfully, lighting up the room. Maria Shatov took a cursory survey of his abode. They told me you lived in a poor way, but I didn't expect it to be as bad as this, she pronounced with an air of disgust, and she moved towards the bed. Oh, I am so tired. She sat down on the hard bed with an exhausted air. Please put down the bag and sit down on the chair yourself. Just as you like, though. You are in the way standing there. I have come to you for a time, till I can get work, because I know nothing of this place and I have no money. But if I shall be in the way, I beg you again, be so good as to tell me so at once, as you are bound to do if you are an honest man. I could sell something tomorrow and pay for a room at an hotel, but you must take me to the hotel yourself. Oh, but I am tired. Shatov was all of a tremor. You mustn't, Marie. You mustn't go to an hotel. An hotel? What for? What for? He clasped his hands imploringly. Well, if I can get on without the hotel, I must anyway explain the position. Remember, Shatov, that we lived in Geneva as man and wife for a fortnight and a few days. It's 3 years since we parted, without any particular quarrel, though. But don't imagine that I've come back to renew any of the foolishness of the past. I've come back to look for work, and that I've come straight to this town is just because it's all the same to me. I've not come to say I am sorry for anything. Please don't imagine anything so stupid as that. Oh, Marie, this is unnecessary, quite unnecessary. Shatov muttered vaguely. If so, if you are so far developed as to be able to understand that, I may allow myself to add that if I've come straight to you now and am in your lodging, it's partly because I always thought you were far from being a scoundrel, and were perhaps much better than other blackguards. Her eyes flashed. She must have had to bear a great deal at the hands of some blackguards. And please believe me, I wasn't laughing at you just now when I told you you were good. I spoke plainly, without fine phrases, and I can't endure them. But that's all nonsense. I always hoped you would have sense enough not to pester me. Enough. I am tired. And she bent on him a long, harassed and weary gaze. Shatov stood facing her at the other end of the room, which was 5 paces away, and listened to her timidly, with a look of new life and unwanted radiance on his face. This strong, rugged man, all bristles on the surface, was suddenly all softness and shining gladness. There was a thrill of extraordinary and unexpected feeling in his soul. 3 years of separation, 3 years of the broken marriage, had effaced nothing from his heart, and perhaps every day during those 3 years he had dreamed of her, of that beloved being who had once said to him, I love you. Knowing Shatov, I can say with certainty that he could never have allowed himself even to dream that a woman might say to him, I love you. He was savagely modest and chaste. He looked on himself as a perfect monster, detested his own face as well as his character, compared himself to some freak only fit to be exhibited at fairs. Consequently, he valued honesty above everything, and was fanatically devoted to his convictions. He was gloomy, proud, easily moved to wrath and sparing of words, but here was the one being who had loved him for a fortnight. That he had never doubted. Never. A being he had always considered immeasurably above him, in spite of his perfectly sober understanding of her errors. A being to whom he could forgive everything. Everything. Of that there could be no question. Indeed, it was quite the other way. His idea was that he was entirely to blame. This woman, this Marya Shatov, was in his house, in his presence again. It was almost inconceivable. He was so overcome. There was so much that was terrible, and at the same time so much happiness in this event, that he could not, perhaps would not, perhaps was afraid to, realize the position. It was a dream. But when she looked at him with that harassed gaze, he suddenly understood that this woman he loved so dearly was suffering, perhaps had been wronged. His heart went cold. He looked at her features with anguish. The first bloom of youth had long faded from this exhausted face. It's true that she was still good-looking, in his eyes a beauty, as she had always been. In reality, she was a woman of 25, rather strongly built, above the medium height, taller than Shatov, with abundant dark brown hair, a pale oval face, and large dark eyes now glittering with feverish brilliance. But the light-hearted, naive, and good-natured energy he had known so well in the past was replaced now by a sullen irritability and disillusionment, a sort of cynicism which was not yet habitual to her herself, and which weighed upon her. But the chief thing was that she was ill. That he could see clearly. In spite of the awe in which he stood of her, he suddenly went up to her and took her by both hands.
"Marie, you know, you are very tired, perhaps. For God's sake, don't be angry. If you'd consent to have some tea, for instance, eh? Tea picks one up so, doesn't it? If you'd consent."
"Why talk about consenting? Of course I consent. What a baby you are still. Get me some if you can. How cramped you are in here. How cold it is."
"Oh, I'll get some logs for the fire directly. Some logs. I've got logs."
Shatov was all astir.
"Logs, that is, but I'll get tea directly."
He waved his hand as though with desperate determination and snatched up his cap.
"Where are you going? So you've no tea in the house?" "There shall be, there shall be, there shall be. There shall be everything directly. I—"
He took his revolver from the shelf.
"I'll sell this revolver directly, or pawn it."
"What foolishness! And what a time that will take! Take my money if you've nothing. There's 80 kopecks there, I think. That's all I have. This is like a madhouse.
I don't want your money. I don't want it. I'll be here directly, in one instant. I can manage without the revolver."
And he rushed straight to Kirillov's. This was probably 2 hours before the visit of Pyotr Stepanovich and Liputin to Kirillov. Though Shatov and Kirillov lived in the same yard, they hardly ever saw each other, and when they met, they did not nod or speak. They had been too long lying side by side in America.
"Kirillov, you always have tea. Have you got tea and a samovar?"
Kirillov, who was walking up and down the room, as he was in the habit of doing all night, stopped and looked intently at his hurried visitor, though without much surprise.
"I've got tea and sugar and a samovar. But there's no need of the samovar. The tea is hot. Sit down and simply drink it." "Kirillov, we lay side by side in America. My wife has come to me. Give me the tea. I shall want the samovar."
"If your wife is here, you want the samovar. But take it later. I've two. And now take the teapot from the table. It's hot, boiling hot. Take everything. Take the sugar, all of it. Bread, there's plenty of bread, all of it. There's some veal. I've a ruble."
"Give it me, friend. I'll pay it back tomorrow." "Ach, Kirillov."
"Is it the same wife who was in Switzerland? That's a good thing.
And you're running in like this. That's a good thing, too.
Kirillov, cried Shatov, taking the teapot under his arm and carrying the bread and sugar in both hands.
Kirillov, if you could get rid of your dreadful fancies and give up your atheistic ravings.
Oh, what a man you'd be, Kirillov.
One can see that you love your wife after Switzerland. It's a good thing you do after Switzerland. When you want tea, come again. You can come all night. I don't sleep at all. There'll be a samovar. Take the ruble. Here it is. Go to your wife. I'll stay here and think about you and your wife.
Marya Shatov was unmistakably pleased at her husband's haste and fell upon the tea almost greedily, but there was no need to run for the samovar. She drank only half a cup and swallowed a tiny piece of bread. The veal she refused with disgust and irritation.
"You are ill, Marie. All this is a sign of illness," Shatov remarked timidly as he waited upon her.
"Of course I'm ill. Please sit down. Where did you get the tea if you haven't any?"
Shatov told her about Kirillov briefly. She had heard something of him.
"I know he is mad. Say no more, please. There are plenty of fools." "So you've been in America. I heard you wrote."
"Yes, I wrote to you in Paris."
"Enough. Please talk of something else. Are you a Slavophil in your convictions?"
I'm not exactly. Since I cannot be a Russian, I became a Slavophil."
He smiled a wry smile with the effort of one who feels he has made a strained and inappropriate jest.
"Why, aren't you a Russian?"
"No, I'm not."
"Well, that's all foolishness. Do sit down, I entreat you. Why are you all over the place? Do you think I am light-headed?"
"Perhaps I shall be."
"You say there are only two in the house?"
"Yes, downstairs."
"And both such clever people. What is there downstairs? You said downstairs?"
"No, nothing."
"Why nothing? I want to know."
"I only meant to say that now we are only two in the yard, but that the Lebyadkins used to live downstairs."
"That woman who was murdered last night?" She started suddenly. "I heard of it. I heard of it as soon as I arrived. There was a fire here, wasn't there?"
"Yes, Marie, yes. And perhaps I'm doing a scoundrelly thing this moment in forgiving the scoundrels."
He stood up suddenly and paced about the room, raising his arms as though in a frenzy. But Marie had not quite understood him. She heard his answers inattentively. She asked questions but did not listen.
"Fine things are being done among you. Oh, how contemptible it all is. What scoundrels men all are. But do sit down, I beg you. Oh, how you exasperate me."
And she let her head sink on the pillow, exhausted.
"Marie, I won't—" "Perhaps you'll lie down, Marie."
She made no answer and closed her eyes helplessly. Her pale face looked deathlike. She fell asleep almost instantly.
Shatov looked round, snuffed the candle, looked uneasily at her face once more, pressed his hands tight in front of him, and walked on tiptoe out of the room into the passage. At the top of the stairs, he stood in the corner with his face to the wall and remained so for 10 minutes without sound or movement. He would have stood there longer, but he suddenly caught the sound of soft, cautious steps below. Someone was coming up the stairs. Shatov remembered he had forgotten to fasten the gate.
"Who's there?" he asked in a whisper.
The unknown visitor went on slowly mounting the stairs without answering. When he reached the top, he stood still. It was impossible to see his face in the dark. Suddenly Shatov heard the cautious question.
"Ivan Shatov."
Shatov said who he was, but at once held out his hand to check his advance. The latter took his hand, and Shatov shuddered as though he had touched some terrible reptile.
"Stand here," he whispered quickly. "Don't go in. I can't receive you just now. My wife has come back. I'll fetch the candle."
When he returned with the candle, he found a young officer standing there. He did not know his name, but he had seen him before.
"Erkel," said the lad, introducing himself. "You've seen me at Virginsky's."
"I remember. You sat writing."
"Listen," said Shatov, in sudden excitement, going up to him frantically, but still talking in a whisper. "You gave me a sign just now when you took my hand. But you know I can treat all these signals with contempt. I don't acknowledge them. I don't want them. I can throw you downstairs this minute. Do you know that?"
"No, I know nothing about that. And I don't know what you are in such a rage about," the visitor answered, without malice and almost ingenuously. "I have only to give you a message, and that's what I've come for, being particularly anxious not to lose time. You have a printing press which does not belong to you, and of which you are bound to give an account, as you know yourself. I have received instructions to request you to give it up tomorrow at 7 o'clock in the evening to Liputin. I have been instructed to tell you also that nothing more will be asked of you."
"Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Your request is granted, and you are struck off our list. I was instructed to tell you that positively."
"Who instructed you to tell me?"
"Those who told me the sign."
"Have you come from abroad?"
I think that's no matter to you."
"Oh, hang it. Why didn't you come before if you were told to?"
"I followed certain instructions and was not alone."
"I understand. I understand that you were not alone." "Aye, hang it. But why didn't Liputin come himself?"
"So I shall come for you tomorrow at exactly 6 o'clock in the evening, and we'll go there on foot. There will be no one there but us three."
"Will Verhovinsky be there?"
"No, he won't. Verhovinsky is leaving town at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning."
"Just what I thought,"
Shatov whispered furiously, and he struck his fist on his hip.
"He's run off, the sneak."
He sank into agitated reflection. Erkel looked intently at him and waited in silence.
"But how will you take it? You can't simply pick it up in your hands and carry it."
"There will be no need to. You'll simply point out the place and we'll just make sure that it really is buried there." "We only know whereabouts the place is. We don't know the place itself."
"And have you pointed the place out to anyone else yet?"
Shatov looked at him.
You, a chit of a boy like you, a silly boy like you. You too have got caught in that net like a sheep." "Yes, that's just the young blood they want. Well, go along. Eh, that scoundrel's taken you all in and run away."
Erkel looked at him serenely and calmly, but did not seem to understand.
Verhovinsky has run away," Shatov growled fiercely.
"But he is still here. He has not gone away. He is not going till tomorrow," Erkel observed softly and persuasively. "I particularly begged him to be present as a witness. My instructions all referred to him," he explained frankly, like a young and inexperienced boy. "But I regret to say he did not agree on the ground of his departure, and he really is in a hurry." Shatov glanced compassionately at the simple youth again, but suddenly gave a gesture of despair, as though he thought, "They are not worth pitying."
"All right, I'll come," he cut him short. "And now get away. Be off."
"So I'll come for you at 6 o'clock punctually." Erkel made a courteous bow and walked deliberately downstairs.
"Little fool,"
Shatov could not help shouting after him from the top.
"What is it?"
responded the lad from the bottom.
"Nothing. You can go now."
"I thought you said something,"